This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We're back here with another live Midrats, and we really appreciate y'all taking time today to join us. And if you are so inclined and you're with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. We'll be there during the course of the show to see what observations you may have or comments about the show. And if you happen to have some questions you would like for us to direct to our guests, that's a great place to put them in. We'll be glad to steal your ideas and claim them as ours as the show goes forward. And if you have to take off and go wash your hands three more times or anything like that, you can go ahead and get the full archive simply by subscribing to the podcast on iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other applications you might have to track your podcast. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with the show. Like we said in some of the pre-show advertisements, for lack of a better phrase, we already have more than one toe in the water. Each year, unmanned systems are taking a larger role at what our Navy does at sea. And our guest today is going to be focused on discussing those and other related topics. And they will be Dr. Bill Burnett and Dr. Todd Holland. And we're going to use their article, Unmanned and Unafraid, The Transformation of Naval Oceanography, as our starting off point. Dr. Burnett is the technical director to the Commander, Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Command. And Dr. Holland is the Chief Scientist for Littoral Oceanography Sensing at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in sunny Panama City Division. He is presently detailed to Dr. Burnett's location. And hey, let's go ahead and start the conversation. Bill and Todd, welcome to Midraps.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
We really appreciate you coming on today to talk with us and our guests about a topic that all mariners have deep to their heart if they're smart. And for some of our guests that may not have a big background at the profession at sea, the sea always has a reputation as being unforgiving, but the lion's share of that unforgiveness happens to be with the weather at sea, how it affects not just the aircraft, but the surface ships and even the submarines. And when you include some of the weaponeering challenges with cruise missiles and hunting submarines, the professionals out there that work weather, oceanography, everything acoustics, that broad spectrum really have a hidden but critical contribution to what we do. And I thought I'd give an opportunity for you. And Bill, we can go ahead and start with you if you'd like. Outline the role of your command in supporting everybody at sea and what your particular role is there.
Well, thank you again. So as you mentioned, I'm the technical director to Rear Admiral John Ocon, who's the commander of the Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Command. And you touched on something early in your broadcast, a quote that we like to use. It's by Felix Risenberg. And the quote is, "The sea is selective, slow at recognition of effort and aptitude, but fast in seeking the unfit." And so Naval Meteorology and Oceanography Command, what we do is we define and apply the physical environment from the bottom of the ocean to the stars. And we do that to ensure that the U.S. has the freedom of action to deter aggression, maintain freedom of seas, and win wars. It's an incredibly important job that we do every day. And we have a command of about 2,500 personnel who work for Admiral Ocon, civilians and military. And they're out there defining the environment, observing the environment, and providing that information to the fleet so they can make decisive determination of how to incorporate the environment into their tactics, techniques, and procedures to be effective and defeat the adversary.
One of the interesting aspects of the article that we're talking about is that you use it to set out some lessons learned, and I guess that's because you all have the most experience in using undersea platforms such as sea gliders and other devices. Can you talk a little bit about the experience that your organization has with these undersea platforms?
So we've used these systems actually for about 20 years. We've incorporated unmanned underwater vehicles into our operations. Primarily, we have about 150 buoyancy gliders. These are gliders that you put into the water, and they are buoyant with the environment that they're in. But you can change the buoyancy just a little bit so that the glider will dive down to 1 kilometer depth. And while it's going down, it measures the ocean temperature and ocean salinity with depth. It reaches that 1 kilometer. It takes about 2 hours to do it. Then it will turn around and return to the surface by changing its buoyancy again, so it's positively buoyant. It goes back to the ocean surface, again, collecting temperature and salinity with as it rises with depth. And once it gets to the surface, it takes that information and transmits it to the Naval Oceanographic Office's Glider Operations Center, which is located at Stennis Space Center, Mississippi. It's a 24/7/365 operations glider center that is always monitoring the gliders that are deployed around the world. So that information, the temperature and salinity, you have two profiles that are critical to understanding how sound moves through the ocean, because it's dependent on temperature and salinity when the density of the water. That data is transmitted to the Naval Oceanographic Office. It's received by the GOC, the Glider Operations Center, and then it's also received by high-performance computers that we have located at Stennis, at the Naval Oceanographic Office. These high-performance computers actually run all our global, regional, and tactical ocean models. So the data that we collect with these unmanned gliders, these buoyancy gliders, are critical to being able to update those models of what the latest temperature salinity is. That data is ingested into the model, and then all the data is used to run predictions out to 10 days at pretty high resolutions for ocean models, which is key information for our submarines, as they have to know what the speed of sound is in the water. It's critical to understanding ocean currents, which supports not only submarines but our surface fleet. And the glider pilots, what they're able to do is they have a location of where the buoyancy glider is. They can turn around and change the next location for the glider to go. And it points to that location, starts diving down 1 kilometer, and comes up again. So that occurs every 4 hours. And that occurs 24 hours a day. So out of 150 gliders, we have usually about a third of the gliders in the water that we're able to collect this information and then inform our ocean models and inform the fleet of what the ocean currents are. That's an enormous amount. You can imagine, I'm sure with your experience, that kind of information, if you had that back when you were active duty, I'm sure you would have really used that information to be able to define how you're going to operate in the ocean. Now that we have that, I think the fleet's seeing an enormous benefit from these buoyancy gliders, and they're the ones that we've been using most for our oceanographic unmanned vehicles systems.
And Todd, let's get go ahead and let you jump in on this question here. And what I wanted to bring the attention to the listener, and if you're with us live, you can find the link in the chat room for the article, is if you're a metrics geek like I am, you love numbers. And one thing we've talked a lot through the years here on MidRats is the unsexy and important things like maintenance and auxiliaries. But when you talk about unmanned systems, they're considered sexy. Everybody likes talking to them, but they're unseen. And most people get excited when they show, you know, what future unmanned systems are going to fly off carriers and deep strike. But they have been doing a lot recently. And one of the quotes from your article talked about, quote, in the past 20 years, NMOC installed a suite of autonomous underwater vehicles on the ships to conduct 1,800 mission surveys of more than 100,000 square kilometers of ocean bathymetry. Little break in the quote there, but here was the real, I thought, impressive part, returning to the quote in the next paragraph, in part, quote, this glider fleet, speaking of the gliders, has traveled almost 250,000 kilometers and already collected more oceanographic profiles than the manned oceanographic survey fleet has in 75 years of operation, unquote. So a lot of people are familiar with that oceanographic fleet, but just looking at what those gliders have been able to do in the last 20 years and the amount of experience that we have used them, I thought I'd roll your way and ask, this use, has it been roughly linear, or has it been more exponential in growth recently? And with the work we've been doing the last two decades, what was the thing you think we went in using them that we expected to see or experience that we didn't? And was there something out there that perhaps was seen as a lower on the hierarchy of things that might be experienced that turned out to be either really important or surprisingly a large consideration in the use of these systems?
Well, so let me talk about this survey fleet, the six ships that we have first, and that'll give you an idea of why these ocean gliders have been able to, the word synergistics kind of difficult sometimes for people to say, like, oh, without rolling their eyes, but they really have been a part and parcel of how our ocean ships, our survey ships, are able to use unmanned systems in a more prolific manner. So our six and seven survey ships, they're four deployed all around the world. The mission of those survey ships are to collect ocean bathymetric data, but also ocean data like temperature, salinity that I talked about earlier. And they're always out there collecting large swath of bathymetry, which is critical to the submarine fleet, of course, and just to the fleet in general. When we're out doing large swath surveys with our survey ships, one of the issues when we wanted to collect a temperature and salinity data is we would have to stop the ship and put over the side of a ship something called a conductivity temperature depth instrument that we would then lower through the water and collect that ocean temperature and salinity. It would reach a certain depth, and then we'd bring it back up. Then we'd have the data, we would analyze it, and then, of course, the ship would go on its way, continuing to survey the bathymetry. You can imagine how that impacts operations when you have to stop the ship to go collect that temperature and salinity data. But if you want to get an accurate measurement of what the bathymetry is, since you're using sound, you need to know how fast that sound is traveling through the water once it reaches the bathymetry and returns. If you use just a standard temperature and salinity measurement, you really don't know what the density of the water is, you might be off on your measurement of what the bathymetry is. So it's critical that we know what the sound speed is of the water. So now with the ocean profilers, we don't have to stop the ships anymore. We might have to stop them just to put the profiling, the buoyancy glider in the water. But once it's in the water, it's out continuously collecting data for the ship to support us in understanding what the sound speed is, where the ship is operating, so they understand how what the true accuracy of the bathymetry is. To me, that's an absolute game changer for us, because we can direct those gliders from our glider operation center to go to areas that we may not have a lot of oceanographic information with in, and so we'll move the glider to that area and collect more information to support the ship's operations. We started in purchasing these buoyancy gliders probably 10, 15 years ago, and we ended up with, we have 150 in our fleet right now. When we first started this, we were kind of trying to figure out how to use the gliders. What do you put them all in the water and risk losing them? Do you put 10 in the water? So what we came up with objectively is a 30%, 30%, 30%, that you'll have so many in the water, 30% in the water, 30% in maintenance, and 30% back at Navoshino ready to transition out to wherever they're going to operate. And they operate for about 3 months at a time while they're in the water. That was a learning curve for us. And we were using, we might have 20, 30 in the water at one time for a number of years. But when Admiral Ocon came on board, he really wanted to push the system and find out what's the maximum number of gliders you can operate. And also, just another side, we don't have one glider pilot per glider. We came up with an idea of let's have 10 glider pilots per one glider. Admiral Ocon also wanted to figure out and to see how could we have the glider pilot do more than just 10. Could they do up to 50 or 60? And back in February 2019, Admiral Ocon directed the Naval Oceanographic Office to put 50 in the water at one time. And we were all very nervous about that, because that got up to maybe one or two glider pilots managing a fleet of 50. But then he also directed that in the summertime, I want to see over 100 in the water. And so the Naval Oceanographic Office rogered on board, and they put 50 in the water in February, and they were able to operate them with a minimum amount of glider pilots. And we were able to retrieve them, which was important, because you put these pieces of equipment in the water, they do have a cost, and we want to make sure we get them back. And then in the summertime, it was stressful to get the 50, but we did it. But what we found out is it was less stressful to put 100 in the water, because we had already worked out a lot of the issues with having 50 in the water. So this is more of a, we're still learning and we're still developing the tactics and techniques of operating unmanned systems like these gliders. The good thing is when they go in the water, they only stay underwater for about 4 hours. And since the ocean's opaque, we're always happy when the glider returns to the surface and says where it's at, because you know, it survives its descent and ascent, and you know where it's at. As we move into the future of unmanned vehicles and autonomous vehicles that are going to be in the water for much longer than 4 hours, we're operating systems now that are in the water for sometimes 12 hours, 18 hours or so. The risk becomes a little bit higher of having to make sure what environment it's going into, what are the currents, and to be pretty confident that the systems that do cost much more than some of the buoyancy gliders that you're going to be able to retrieve successfully. And I could say that all the unmanned underwater vehicles, well, maybe not the buoyancy gliders, but the unmanned underwater vehicles that are in the water for much longer, we have had a 100% retrieval rate. And that's because we know the ocean bottom, we know the ocean currents, and we know what we're doing. And that's been 20 years of building that type of expertise. I'll let Todd Holland answer some of the other parts of your question.
So with respect to the rapid growth. I think we want to back up just a little bit. I think the role of naval research is to establish what advancements, either scientific or technical, could be made for application to naval operators. And there's no better group of operators than the 2,000 some odd personnel working in naval oceanography. It's an exciting area to be involved with. But just as you can imagine, the unmanned technologies have really been exploding within the last decade. So I would say most people are familiar with what's going on with unmanned air systems or aerial vehicles, aircraft systems. But I would say in the last 5 years, same thing's happening with what we're calling maritime systems. And so these would be whether it's an unmanned vehicle operating on the surface of the ocean or underwater. The number types and solutions that are being developed is really just growing extremely fast. And I would say in the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen really an explosion. So we, within naval research, want to focus on sensing using those platforms. So we're not just going to drive the vehicles around. We also want to collect some observations while we're out there. These are the observations that really support the decisions that naval oceanography has to make. But there's an additional part to this mission, and that is taking these observations and assimilating them into whether it's ocean or meteorological models to allow the Navy to have a forecast of the weather, essentially. And so we've been doing that for several decades, and the utility of those models, they're developed within naval research, and then they transition over to Navocino and Benmoc for use. And I think that's really, the answer to your question, is the ability to get that sense data from an unmanned system into those models really has taken off in the last 2 to 3 years. And so a lot of exciting stuff happening, but it's fairly recent that the majority of the true excitement has occurred.
Yeah, it's during the research for this show, I was impressed by the amount of information that's out there. You know, and some of these things that have kind of existed for a while, like the Argo system, which has been around for a while. A lot of the information that some people, you know, want to know more about, and some of the technical details, which I think they'd probably get if they went to the manufacturers. But, you know, how are these gliders powered, and how are you all keeping track of them? Or are they reporting up to a satellite system? Exactly, you know, within whatever you can tell us about that.
Sure. The gliders that we're using are commercial systems that have been developed both for academia and other uses, but we take the information that is collected from them, and there's a number of different types of information, and Bill kind of referred to that a little bit, but as these vehicles move up and down in the water column, they're collecting temperature and essentially a salinity type observation, and we use those in the models. And that information is not extremely dense, and so we're able to package it into an Iridium message. And so this is kind of almost a satellite cell phone capability that a lot of different portions of the Department of Defense and commercial companies use. Those messages can be sent anywhere in the world, and they travel via satellite, and the data gets back to Navocino, where it is quality controlled and parsed to look at what type of information should go to which oceanographic or meteorological model. There's data coming in from more than just the gliders as well. There's meteorological sensors, and there's other types of oceanographic sensors out there that we leverage. And you mentioned the Argo floats. There's another example. So that information gets back and is pretty rigorously controlled, and I think that's what separates what naval oceanography's expertise is from some of the other, perhaps more academic applications.
Yeah, and one of the things, it's important that what we learned early on, to have a real-time glider operations center that is giving overwatch of where all these systems are deployed. For the most part, when they're in the water and they're operating for 3 months, they're reporting their positions as they're supposed to. The pilots are checking the battery. There is a battery set, not to power the glider per se, but to ensure that once the equipment is on the surface, that it can transmit video Iridium back to the Naval Oceanographic Office. The buoyancy itself is what powers these gliders and allows them to move from one location to another. But you have to have the pilots there just to provide the overwatch, ensure that the systems are operating as normal. And if they are operating as normal, everything's fine, and there's not a lot for the glider pilot to do except just ensure that it's going to the right location and providing the data. The issue becomes when the gliders start having problems. Maybe it's not as buoyant as it's supposed to, or it's not completing its depth, or the battery is not charging, and they're using up more battery life than it's supposed to, or sometimes something just happens with the equipment when it's underwater. And when something happens, what it will do is eject its weight that keeps it buoyant. And then once that weight's ejected, the glider will come right to the surface. So when that happens, we want to be able to get our survey ships or a ship out to the area as soon as possible so we can pick up the glider. So it's not just sitting at the surface. And so having that overwatch, being able to understand where all the pieces of equipment are, and when they're coming up to their three-month life cycle, that we can put them in an area where they can be retrieved. That's just a critical part of being able to successfully employ and operate any type of unmanned vehicle, underwater or surface vehicle, is to have that overwatch.
One topic related to that is, I wonder, with unmanned systems, I know we had a conversation a few shows ago about the loss rate and the cost they've had on the air side of the house. And we've had some proactive loss back in 2016, even though they returned it. The Chinese managed to snag one of our gliders. And I think earlier this year, a Croatian fisherman snagged one of our more traditional buoyed systems. And what have we seen about the loss rate of our unmanned systems? Were they in line with what we expected, better or worse? And how does that impact our planning and budgeting?
So we're constantly monitoring the maintenance upkeep of our unmanned vehicles and buoyancy gliders. And I try to keep the difference there on purpose, just so when I call unmanned underwater vehicles, they're ones that stay in the water for a longer period of time than the buoyancy vehicles, than the buoyancy gliders. We do have a very good understanding of the rate of failures that we're getting on our buoyancy gliders, and we've actually gone back and worked with the vendor to correct some of the issues that we're seeing. And so that's a good feedback loop to go back to industry, say, this is what we're looking for, this needs to be corrected. And usually they turn that around, and if there's something that they can fix on the next build or next delivery, they'll turn around and do that. So we do work with vendors very closely about the things that we see, and since this is a nascent area where unmanned vehicles are being operated primarily by the Naval Oceanography, we're getting a lot of information that people are very interested in learning more about our success in operating these vehicles. Of course, for research and development, they also can take that type of information and turn it into support for improvements to other vehicles as well.
The The capabilities that we put together have been improved dramatically over the last, decade, and I think that the loss rate's really quite low and impressive. Imagine that you're out on the other side of the ocean, and that might have been the only vehicle that's ever, ocean's a big place, that might be the only observation that's ever been in that previous area. And so having to figure out how to survive in a changing environment that perhaps could have some fairly drastic consequences if you don't adapt appropriately while there is no pilot on board is quite challenging. So I'm impressed with our success rate, and it's really quite remarkable when you think about you're essentially operating blind for much of the time, but that team of pilots and the coupled models that they leverage has been incredibly successful, in my opinion, in moving us to a really high capability.
Well, as you look forward to operations and you pointed this out in your article about the future. I mean, how big an issue is bandwidth in times of more stressful conditions than perhaps we're operating under right now? And you said something about operating swarm-like. I mean, it's part of your lessons learned, swarm-like situations. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Sure. This is Todd. So I think the concept of autonomous swarm operations is a really good one. I'm excited about it. However, we have not fully developed what that's going to look like. And so I think the alternative is to put a lot of capability into a single vehicle. And those tend to get really expensive and complicated. And so, that is an opportunity that large portions of the Navy are considering. But we're, on the environmental side, probably interested in lower cost, low complexity sensors and systems. And maybe they have different types of ability. And so I'm going to get back to your question on the bandwidth. You're right. You're not going to be able to send everything back to the command center for evaluation. So we're looking at options now to have different types of sensors deployed in a collaborative manner. And so maybe you can cover more area with 10 cheap sensors than you could with one expensive sensor, or maybe even go to hundreds and thousands. And so these miniaturized, low complexity sensors will provide it's a balance, right? They could provide data back, but it would be better if they could provide decisions back, which are a lot easier to transmit than passing the whole data stream. So how much processing power do you put out forward? That costs money, that takes electricity and power, versus how much do you send back for analysis later? And so that's something we're actively looking at right now. There's a balance between those two options. We presently are investigating a fairly large swarm of different types of instruments in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're receiving the data back, but there's this active investigation of letting the cheap, fairly straightforward, low complexity platform make some decisions forward and just pass back what the platform thinks is the most valuable. Because like you said, bandwidth is limited. So something we're working on. I think want to make sure that you're catching the difficulty we're talking about here. It could be multiple domains, right? So to be able to transition to swarming operations, perhaps you have some vehicles on the surface, some vehicles underwater, and perhaps even some in the air. And so now these have to communicate between each other, plus also back to the command center or operations center. As we said, having less expensive operating in a coordinated fashion makes sense from a financial perspective, but it's something we're really still investigating. So more to come.
You mentioned one item that you talked about earlier were the Argo floats. And I'd just like to highlight what a success story that's been for the oceanographic community. Argo floats have been operations now for a number of years. They aren't you aren't able to move the profiling floats. They actually just move with the ocean current. And for the listeners, how they operate it, you deploy them at the surface, at the water surface, and then similar to gliders, they down with depth and take a profile of ocean temperature and salinity. as they slowly descend down to about 1,000 kilometers or 1,000 meters, 1 kilometer. And then they will reside at that depth for about 10 days, moving with the lower water column at that depth. And then after 10 days, they return to the surface and they collect a temperature salinity profile once they return to the surface. And then that data is transmitted to through a international network, communications network, where all the nations can receive that data. It's a joint collaborative international group that that operates the Argo fleet. Each nation actually deploys and operates a certain number of the entire Argo fleet. And that data goes into our ocean models and improves the types of information that we need for our oceanographic models, and then also gives us a better understanding of how the oceans are changing with time as well. And it's a great success story that they're not usually called autonomous or unmanned underwater vehicles, but they're floats that aren't operated by humans in real time and have a great data collection capability at a cheap cost.
Cost is always the key. And all this talk about temperature, salinity, brings to mind sound velocity profiles. I can't help but have the passive and active sonar equation bouncing around in my head. And we've seen in the last, especially half decade or so, a renewed interest after a very long time of being ignored of anti-submarine warfare. You know, the Brits are playing catch up as we are in some areas as well. And I was wondering, in the oceanography world, has this revival of interest and the requirements of anti-submarine warfare, has that translated into additional interest in what you're doing, or more importantly, increase in funding? Because you know better than I do that I remember a story from early on at the end of the last decade. There was a senior policy advisor who was talking about a couple of things that was going on. And this individual just had no idea that once the water surface, whether you're talking about the Baltic, the middle of the Atlantic, or what goes on in the South China Sea, that they're very, very different in how you can employ and defend against things that go sinker, so to speak. So long way of coming around, has this revival of interest helped your research and to get the fundings to it to advance the systems and programs?
Well, I would say that from the oceanographic community, we've always been responsible to understand the oceanographic environment and be able to translate what the ocean is in real time, the temperature, salinity, what the density of that ocean is, and also provide predictions in time. And throughout the last 20, 30 years, we have been able to improve not only our observations capability, which is really, that's the fundamental, one of the baselines foundations for our community is what are the observations, what's going on in real time right now in terms of the ocean, in terms of the atmosphere. We have to have those observations first. And these types of programs, like unmanned underwater vehicles, our survey ship program, the buoyancy gliders, have really helped us get a much better, higher resolution understanding of the ocean environment and ocean observations. I can also say in the last 20, 30 years, we have been consistent in our high-performance computing. As you know, supercomputing is critical to being able to run higher and higher ocean models to get a better prediction of the ocean environment out to 10 days. There's a clear trend in the higher resolution your atmosphere and ocean models are, the better your predictions and the higher accuracy you have for your oceanographic and atmospheric modeling that you can give to the fleet. But all of that is immaterial if you don't turn that information into decisions for the submarine fleet and for our surface fleet as well, and of course for the air. Turning that into decisions is really one of our goals. And Admiral Ocon, what he looks at the way we provide our information. We call it a battlespace on demand pyramid. Battlespace on demand, there's different tiers. Tier zero are the observations. Tier one are the numerical models and the predictions. And then tier two and tier three are turning that type of information into decisions. So what we want to do is to compress the tier zero and tier one, the time it takes to be able to collect the data, run the models, so we can provide more time to the decision maker to be able to say, all right, this is what the environment's like, this is what the predictions are saying, how can I use that information to better assist where I'm going to position the fleet or how I'm going to do tactics to conduct an operation. So in the future, what we're going to do is hopefully get more observations through unmanned vehicles and the equipment that we've just talked about, and tighten up the time that we're running our numerical models so they can get them out to the fleet faster into tactical decision aids, improving tactical decision aids so that information can then improve the and give more time back to the decision maker. I'll let Todd talk about how research and development is also looking at the future.
I think one of the topics that we're touching on here is that it's not just the vehicles, the sensors, and the computers, and even the Overwatch team working together. It's really the concepts of how the tactics, techniques, and procedures are all going to operate together in the ocean. And that's really complicated, and it probably depends upon who's involved in the use of that information, what decision maker in that bond pyramid are we targeting. But I do think there's a common thread that no matter what development we're going to pursue with unmanned systems, it really requires a holistic approach that involves scientists, maybe interdisciplinary scientists from a variety of different subject matters, engineers, oceanographers, our military and warfighting personnel working together to kind of look at what possible solutions are there. And there's a couple things I would like to mention that we've done to move that capability or the new ideas of unmanned systems pretty rapidly. And one of those is working through the warfare centers on what's called the Advanced Naval Technology Exercise. And one of the lessons learned we have, I think, is something along the lines of the three E's, engage end users early. And so the idea is rather than the traditional approach of developing a new capability from scratch, and you start off with an idea, and then many years later there's a solution. Instead, we want to go harvest what available technology there is today. And ANTEX is a way to do that. It's hosted by a number of different commands. If you Google around, you'll find a variety of them. But we work with the Naval Undersea Warfare Center in Newport, Rhode Island. And there's capability at Dennis with SIMMOC to couple what SIMMOC's interests are with the ANTEX experimentation. And so that allows us to get out there and see this technology, work with it and determine if there's any new either capabilities on the industry side or maybe there's new concepts on how we want to leverage these technologies. So ANTEX is one. The other thing we've done is what's called an other transactional authority. And so this is an authority that Department of Defense has been granted to procure on a fairly limited basis prototypes. And so we have been fortunate enough to work under the OTA to develop some new capabilities. Last year, we actually worked with an unmanned surface vehicle. And the reason I'm bringing it up is it wasn't for the procurement of the technology per se. It was an opportunity to rapidly learn about the TTPs, the tactics, techniques, and procedures that we need to employ to make new unmanned systems work together. And so both of those have been incredibly valuable. We are actively pursuing both ANTECs and OTAs. And I think that we're really, engage early with these fleet operators. We'll give them the feedback they need so that industry and academia can respond to these operational requirements. I don't know, do you have anything you wanted to add on ANTECs, Dr. Burnett?
So the Advanced Naval Technology Exercise has been an excellent way for our community to see what's out there in technology, work closer with industry and academia to be able to take their technologies and rapidly prototype them and hopefully get them into operations. That's been one of Admiral Okon's key objectives out of his strategic plan that he delivered a couple years ago. One of them was innovation, and as part of innovation was to leverage as much as we can with academia and industry. So ANTECs, there's two types of ANTECs. One is an ANTEC that occurs over in Newport, where they provide water space to industry, and industry brings all their capabilities to the area, talks about what they have, and demonstrates it in the water space. We do things a bit differently down in the ANTECs exercises that we have along the Gulf Coast. Since we do have quite a few military and civilian members that are working with unmanned systems, what we want to do is get our operators, sailors and civilians, partnering with industry. And instead of industry telling us what they could do, we actually have our operators work on the systems. We develop vignettes that we say, we would like to test out this vignette, and does your piece of equipment meet the objectives of that vignette? An example would be a hurricane that goes into the area, let's say Gulfport, and does a lot of damage at the port. How fast can we use unmanned systems to go in and survey the port, find out where the objects are in the bottom of the water, so hopefully they can be removed so we can get ships into the area for supplies? Then you look at the difference of how long would it take if you didn't have the unmanned vehicle capability versus if you did have that, what's the time reduction that you can expect with unmanned vehicles? Also, hopefully you can get a better understanding of maybe a vehicle operates at the surface, then dives down, does a survey, and then comes back to the surface, and then transmits that data to a local command center or ship, so we can process that data, maybe even on the unmanned underwater vehicle, and get that information to the ship. So then we can decide, all right, this is an area that you can use to send the supply ships in to get to the impacted area. So ANTECs is a great opportunity for us. It's brought us closer with, I think, our warfare community, certainly closer with academia and with industry as well. And you can imagine industry has some fantastic ideas of how they want to move forward with unmanned vehicles.
Well, I sit here and think, well, Halsey and Nimitz would have loved to have you you guys around. And in fact, when I was on the destroyers and we were dropping buoys and sending up weather balloons, I think we would have loved to have some of this information too. Which brings the next question is, what kind of feedback, what kind of training are you giving to the fleet about what you have available to them? And what kind of feedback do you all get from the fleet about the information you're able to provide them?
So what we're doing right now is working with the warfare centers. We're taking what we call for naval oceanography, our tactics, techniques, and procedures. And as the U.S. Navy moves forward with operating more underwater surface and aerial vehicles, the key thing that we have to do is ensure that they understand the environment that they're going to operate in. Unmanned aerial vehicles, they are impacted by icing, so we're working closely with different groups to provide them with a route recommendation. based on what could expected icing be for where their unmanned aerial vehicles are going to go. An aside, you mentioned weather balloons. Admiral Ocon received a brief from Scripps University on quadcopters that can go up and take a temperature relative humidity profile from a ship. So go up, take that profile, and then come back down and relay that information. So moving away from the weather balloon technology to unmanned aerial vehicles to get a faster and better understanding, more of a high-resolution understanding, because you can take the quadcopter and move it down to the ocean surface and then back up to the ship to get information that you could never do with a balloon. Surface vehicles, we have a few unmanned surface vehicles. We're learning more about them and how they can help us collect bathymetry profiles. And, of course, most of our knowledge is in the unmanned underwater vehicle technology. Primarily, if you're going to put an unmanned underwater vehicle in the water, here's the type of conditions that you can expect. And giving them the understanding of here's how we operate them. We operate them for this many hours. They go to this depth. Make sure that if they have any problems that you have some sort of ship nearby that can retrieve it. And usually there are problems. It's kind of like hitting the reset button on your computer or the escape button. If an unmanned underwater vehicle has a problem, it'll reject its weight and then come to the surface. So you just have to be prepared for being able to retrieve that piece of equipment when it does come to the surface. But primarily, one is telling them what the ocean and atmospheric environment's like, and then asking the fleet as they're moving into these types of systems to collect more ocean atmosphere observations on their vehicle. So if we know where their vehicle is, what type of environment is in, if they're collecting that information, we can also put that into our modeling suite and give a better prediction to the operators of the unmanned vehicles. So we're giving as much information as we can to the U.S. Navy to make sure they're moving out smartly and building out their unmanned fleet.
I think one of the real strengths of naval oceanography is a lot of the unmanned systems use in the Navy is very short duration. So many of the conditions might be just a few hours long, but this knowledge of what we call persistence, you know, with the gliders out there for up to 3 months, that's not really being exercised by anybody other than naval oceanography. So we really bring a lot of capability to the other fleets on how they need to think about the future, because that's a real challenge. If you haven't tested for months, you're not going to be familiar with all the things that can occur over that time period. You need a large area to operate in, and we need to think about how we're going to do that. And you need to have, as we were talking earlier, this balance between the vehicle understanding its environment to some extent, but the operators also having the ability to influence the vehicle. So there's no better group than kind of the folks at Naval Oceanography to address those challenges, and I think that's really one of the biggest strengths that we provide.
A couple things that I wanted to tie together in the show is you mentioned early on about the energy requirements to do the type of reach back you need to do, sending a bunch of data for offboard processing. That and some of the exciting thing that's happening out in industry. And in the article, you mentioned as one of your points of future challenges, quote, future autonomy will require efficient processing of onboard environmental sensor data to direct decision-making, unquote. That kind of reads as AI, machine learning, something in that area. And I know when it comes to unmanned systems, the agricultural business sector has been working a lot in this type of area. And I was wondering, what industry sectors do you see a little bit of parallel development taking place when it comes to what you see for requirements for machine learning or AI for our unmanned systems?
I think I think it's a good question on analogies, but it's a difficult one in that you brought this up earlier. The disadvantage we have in the maritime realm is our communication. So those tractors that are driving around in the fields, they've got constant GPS and constant cellular comms back to the, you know, kind of the command center, and we just don't have that. And so there's a little bit of difference there. I do think AI and machine learning are interesting, and there are certainly a number of people working on that. But let me bring up kind of a related challenge that I think there is an analogy to other groups. And that is, you know, we have to address the level of trust in using unmanned systems for all types of military operations, but certainly for long durations. And that means that you have to balance what the system is able to accomplish on its own with the end users receiving that data. And that to me is a much more interesting topic because, you know, you're almost getting into how smart do the computers need to be on these vehicles versus how much can we let the human continue to do. There's lots of discussions of, you know, onboard processing versus offboard processing, but there's also discussions of human in the loop, out of the loop, over the loop. So how exactly do we want to solve those? And I think that what we have experience with in Naval Ocean RFP goes a long way, but there's still a long way to go with that. And I know there's other areas that have had to deal with that issue as well, this human factors and computer interaction.
I think the part that our article really highlighted was there's still a need for a human in the loop. And we having that oversight of where the equipment is, you have to have humans who deploy the equipment and retrieve it. You have to have humans that are able to maintain it. Sometimes when you're out in the water, you can't take your piece of equipment to a shop and get it repaired. You have to have everything on board the survey ship to be able to fix the equipment. So we're always making changes to the equipment when they're out in the water, and humans are our oceanographers. Our engineers that work in Naval Oceanography are absolutely critical to making sure that our unmanned maritime fleet is operating properly and conducting their missions. So I don't know when autonomy will occur where you can just have systems operating on their own. I think it's going to be a while yet. But fortunately for our Naval Oceanographers that are out there, they play a key role in making sure that everything from deployment, retrieval, operations, maintenance, getting the data quality controlled and into models. Unmanned does not mean that you don't have naval oceanographers, naval oceanographic engineers, IT specialists, physicists, mathematicians. Our civilian workforce and our sailors are just indelible to making sure that unmanned systems provide an advantage and provide critical information while we're continuing to do the job that sailors and civilians are meant to do.
Yeah, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming on this show. I think this is one of those areas where everybody in the fleet appreciates the information we get from your community. I don't think we always understand where it comes from or how hard you all are working to improve that. And it's been a real pleasure having you on to discuss it and hopefully open a few people's eyes to an important part of the naval business. Before we let you go, though, is there something that you guys are working on that you'd like to talk about so that our listeners can check up on you every now and then?
Well, so I just want to end with, we like to say that Naval Oceanography starts with us. There isn't an aircraft that flies, a ship or submarine that sails without the people of Naval Oceanography. I'm incredibly proud to be a part of this community and for the mission that they conduct every day. They're out there just doing as much as they can to support the U.S. Navy, the Department of Defense, and ultimately the American public. I think it's important to remember as you think about Naval Oceanography that the margin and advantage between the U.S. Navy and others is thinning and becoming thinner. So knowledge of the air, knowledge of the ocean, seafloor, the stars, of course, is even more critical now for operating forces. And you giving us the opportunity just to talk a little bit about naval oceanography and how we incorporate unmanned maritime systems into our operations. Thank you very much for giving us the chance to give you some more information about our community.
I certainly enjoy the opportunity, Sal, Eagle One. It was very enjoyable. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we really appreciate the y'all taking time this Sunday afternoon to come on and join us. And we'll definitely keep an eye on you because weather's not going anywhere, neither are the oceans. So hope y'all have a great 2020 and look forward to an opportunity to see the next article y'all have written.
Thank you.
Sounds great.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.